Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Over the years, a team of Australian National University researchers has had access to a generally hidden realm. They've pored through the archives and interviewed former spies to piece together an official history of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO. The third volume of this series, written by John Blaxland and Rhys Crawley, is published this week, and it deals with the period leading to the end of the Cold War, during the Fraser and Hawke years. John Blaxland joins us today to discuss what's been unearthed in this new volume. John Blaxland, this is the third volume of the official history. How was the life of ASIO from 1975 to 1989, the period you've covered, different to the earlier periods of the organisation?
Thank you, Michelle. It's interesting. The difference is largely a reflection of the differences in Australian society. When ASIO was formed in 1949, ASIO was a reflection of that society. The post-war era, the Cold War had started, politics was quite polarised, there was a concern about espionage, and there was an organisation set up to hunt out the spies. That was what David Horne has written about in The Spy Catchers, the first volume of the three-volume history of ASIO. The second volume, the protest years, covers the Vietnam War era and the Whitlam era. And there was a significant change happening in society reflecting the baby boomers, the rise of the baby boomers, and the reactions to the establishment and what was happening in Vietnam. Time of protest, exactly. And so ASIO really struggled to come to grips with that. With the third volume, we see Australia going through a bit of a metamorphosis. There's the years of Malcolm Fraser as Prime Minister and Bob Hawke. And the Fraser years, there's still a lot of resentment over what had happened the dismissal of Gough Whitlam. And there were security concerns arising from that get covered in the book. We also see Malcolm Fraser does some very interesting things. He invites in migrants from Vietnam, and we had that was added to several waves of migrants from Southern Europe and the Balkans and other parts of the world that were making Australia increasingly a multicultural place, but increasingly a place where people of security concern could hide in amongst migrant communities. That generated a whole series of concerns. But of course, it was also a time of detente in the Cold War. The dark days of the Cold War, it seemed, had appeared to have passed. Nixon had gone to China. There'd been a rapprochement there. Gough Whitlam himself had gone as opposition leader and then as prime minister, had established diplomatic relations with China. So there seemed to be a thawing of the Cold War. But beneath all of that, the Cold War was still on, full steam ahead. And that's the essence of the secret Cold War. The fact that the Soviet Union's presence was growing, the fact that Eastern Bloc countries, the former Soviet satellites, were establishing growing diplomatic presences in Australia, the fact that China had a presence, the fact that Vietnam and other countries had diplomatic presences, all provided openings for them to get engaged in espionage, generating additional requirements for counter-espionage.
And of course, the Soviets were always on the lookout, and one of the early experiences of the Hawke government was, in fact, a security crisis, wasn't it, that ASIO presented it with, because David Coomer, former National Secretary of the ALP, had become quite close to one of the guys in the Soviet embassy, and there was a fear that he was going to be recruited.
Yes.
Tell us about that incident.
A very interesting one. Ivanov was a clear, legitimate target of ASIO. He was under warrant. His house was bugged by ASIO with clear legal authority. And in so doing, David Coombe crossed ASIO's crosshairs, if you like. And initially that wasn't a grave concern. ASIO noted it, and particularly in the dying days of the Fraser government, it made a note. It didn't report this to Fraser or to the government directly, but it was conscious that this was happening. But on the election eve itself, David Coombe goes to Valerie Ivanov's house, and there the conversation is recorded, which appears to indicate the initial steps of Coombe being co-opted to be prepared to be an agent of influence, if not more than that, working for the KGB. Now, that's not what happens, but it's what appeared to be on the cusp of happening. And the Director General of ASIO, Harvey Barnett, saw this and was deeply concerned about what the implications were. But he'd also not established a strong relationship with the incoming Attorney General, Gareth Evans. Gareth Evans had been very public in civil liberties matters, had been outspoken in Parliament, critical of ASIO in certain measures. And there was a right of access for the Director General, direct to the Prime Minister, and Harvey Barnett exercised that and effectively, in so doing, circumvented the Attorney General, Gareth Evans.
I bet Gareth Evans wasn't too happy about
that. Well, Gareth was a bit distracted because of the incident of the overflights of the dam, the Franklin River Dam project in Tasmania. And so he was getting a lot of flack about that, and so he was a little bit distracted at the time. But this really generated a conundrum for Hawke, because when Harvey Barnett went to brief Hawke on this, Hawke realised, and he had very strongly in his mind, the experience of Gough Whitlam and then in the dying days of the Whitlam government, when there was considerable angst generated in the intelligence community and particularly in the United States about where the Australian ship of state was heading under Whitlam. Bob Hawke was pretty clear he didn't want to take that same course and was keen to burnish his credentials with the Americans and with the security establishment in Australia. So he was pretty outspoken. He decided to go beyond what Harvey Barnett had actually expected to take place. He thought that there'd be a number of measures happen slowly and over the next few weeks, and Bob Hawke precipitated sudden action. And that caught Harvey Barnett off guard, it caught ASIO off guard, and it generated, once it got out into the media, it generated a whole range of concerns, which then led to the Royal Commission on Australia's security intelligence agencies.
So the Russian was thrown out and Coombe was banned from having contact with ministers or ministers with Coombe, and a minister also got caught up in this when he told a mate that the expulsion was coming. So there were heads rolling all over the place.
Yes, there were. It was Bob Hawke's best mate, his special minister of state, who was appointed as part of the coming into office of Mick Young into office. And of course, Mick leaked the fact that this deliberation had happened in cabinet. And Prime Minister Hawke had explicitly said, no one is to pass this to Coombe or to let anyone else outside of cabinet know about the deliberations that were unfolding. The matter leaked and Hawke sacked Young and then generated considerable media attention, and that was all linked to the Royal Commission.
Now, initially, ASIO was patting itself on the back over this whole affair, wasn't it? Because the spy had been expelled. Mm. But then quickly it sort of turned back on ASIO,
yes.
This affair?
In 1963, a Russian spy had been kicked out, Ivan Skripov, and Harvey Barnett was conscious that the previous time there'd been a international or public saga about espionage. It had led to the Royal Commission on Espionage, which was politically very difficult in the mid-1950s. And he didn't want a similar political fiasco to envelop ASIO. So he thought he was being clever by dealing with this after Fraser left office and taking it directly to the Prime Minister. But what he didn't appreciate was just how difficult this would be for him when it went to the Royal Commission, when the media got wind of the details, and when that started to be worked, when the machinations of that started to be worked through very much in the public
domain. And the Prime Minister himself appeared at that Royal Commission, I think.
In fact, Bob Hawke was perhaps his most compelling when he presented himself to the Royal Commission and stoutly defended his government's actions and on the appropriateness of the not only the role of ASIO, but the functions that had been performed at this juncture. Now, we know in hindsight that David Coombe wasn't planning on becoming a spy. There was no clear indications that that was the case, and that this preemptive move had actually brought onto ASIO a lot of consternation, a lot of opprobrium that was difficult for ASIO to deal with. But as a consequence, one of the things, it had a really quite a cathartic effect on the organisation, because the Royal Commission that Justice Hope had presided over, led to significant additional reforms. Now, there'd been reforms that had been initiated under Whitlam's time that were followed through under Fraser and carried effectively implemented, largely implemented in the Fraser years. Hawke's Royal Commission that Hope chaired or presided over generated significant additional reforms. And we're actually living with the legacy of those reforms today. So the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, Security Appeals Tribunal, the Parliamentary Joint Committees for Oversight. These are mechanisms that came out of the two Hope Royal Commissions, the one in the mid-70s and the one that was linked to the Coombe-Ivanov affair in 83-84.
How active were the Russians in spying in this period? You cover the late 70s through the 80s in Canberra.
So active that the work of ASIO was not sufficient to cover what they were doing. Effectively, ASIO found itself dealing with a grown Soviet presence and a proliferation of Soviet bloc consulates and diplomatic presences that were simply beyond it. They weren't resourced to monitor them all. And so we now know that while ASIO was doing what it could, it was in a position where it was simply outpaced. They did not have the number of officers and agents in place to monitor the incredible growth in the number of diplomats cum spies operating in Canberra, Sydney, Melbourne and elsewhere. And as a consequence, while what they did was, to the best of their ability, there are strong indications that there were workarounds that ASIO simply was not across.
And I recall from the earlier volumes that their observational habits were fairly primitive, chasing people down the street and catching trams and so on. Did it become by this stage a much more sophisticated operation? Because we're still talking about a time that's pre-high tech.
It's getting more sophisticated. The two Hope Royal Commissions generate growth. They generate demand for more resources allocated to ASIO. So ASIO recruits more people. ASIO instigates training programs, more methodical and rigorous professional training.
People.
Recruits more educated people. And late in the piece, it relocates to Canberra. And that actually all helps to put ASIO in a much more centred place, if you like, in terms of it being responsive to and accountable to government, and also a much more professional organisation, one that has inculcated skills and an ethos more consistent with the values of a society that had morphed, effectively. The society of 1949 was very different to the one of 1989, and there had been significant legislative and organisational changes, which we try and capture in this book.
Were they still watching the Russians from the funeral parlour over the road, or had they been booted out or given it up by that stage?
The Russians were watched from many vantage points. Many vantage points.
That used to be the great story in Canberra, of course.
Look, there are lots of interesting aspects on the story, and there's quite a lot of photos in the book too about the Soviet embassy, about various other diplomatic presences, residences in Canberra and elsewhere that speak to the amount of effort that ASIO put into monitoring diplomatic activity and espionage.
I noted a reference in relation to the Ivanov house that over some days or a weekend or something that ASIO got back in and put microphones in the house. Mm. How was that done?
Well, look, this is actually a very involved operation, because what they had to do was, when they knew, and having monitored the house and tracked when Ivanov was not going to be in the house, they then had to track all the other Soviet diplomatic people around Canberra. So it was a very labour-intensive work to make sure that they could keep a track on the others to then be able to enter the premises, conduct the installation, install the microphones in various locations around the house, and get out before Ivanov returned or before anyone else turned up.
How do you explain yourself if his wife happens to come home from work early wherever she was?
Well, that's it. Well, she was closely monitored as well. They were all closely monitored. You know, this is the thing. One of the consequences of this operation is that thereafter it's actually much more difficult to monitor, because, of course, it becomes public that ASIO has done this. So ASIO's methodology is now part of the public folklore, if you like. And so everybody, as a consequence, people's behaviour adjusts. People are much more circumspect.
So the decline of the Cold War, or the end, I suppose, the sort of formal end of the Cold War, comes at the end of your period, doesn't it?
Mm.
What difference did that make to ASIO's focus, its operations, or was that a very gradual change in practice?
Well, I mean, Volume 3 goes to the end of the Cold War. It doesn't deal with the post-Cold War period. And I think, you know, there's probably an argument to be made for another volume to be written down the track on the future, the next stage of ASIO's life. But one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about the secret Cold War is how many of these issues have a very contemporary feel to them. The issues of terrorism, of bombings, of espionage, of proliferation, of targets that are difficult to track, and so the whole range of the emergence of the articulation of what terrorism's about, and the various manifestations of that in ethnic communities in people coming in briefly to Australia to conduct assassination raids and then leaving. As Australia becomes more cosmopolitan, more part of the world, connected to the world, it is increasingly exposed to some of the bad eggs, if you like. And that then, while this, you know, seems quite a long while ago, 1975 to 1989, as I've reread that, I thought, wow, so much of this is so true still today. My sense is that people, when reading this, will think this has got a remarkable contemporary feel to it.
These days, we're always hearing from the government, from the authorities, that such and such a plot has been foiled with the help of ASIO as well as the police. What sort of plots were foiled in those days? Where were the threats coming from? And I think we didn't hear so much public notification at that period. Am I right in that?
No, I think you're right. There wasn't the same level of public notification. There wasn't the sense of that being an appropriate thing to do, because of the scale of things. Let's not forget, though, there were quite a few that snuck through. The Hakoa Club bombing, the Westfield Towers bombing, the Turkish consulate bombing.
And those groups were what groups?
Well, this is the thing. It's actually hard to nail down exactly who was behind these groups. We know that in the case of the Turkish bombing, the Justice Commandos of the Armenian Genocide are closely linked with that. So, you know, Armenian migrant groups and, most of them, the overwhelming majority of them are settled here without any ill intent towards others. But there are elements of that. And the Ananda Marga itself, a group that is closely associated with the Hilton Hotel bombing, a group that made up, in Australia's case, mostly of Australian citizens, but who have a sense of attachment to the movement, and felt aggrieved at what was taking place in India, seeking for the guru to be released from jail, and taking really drastic measures to
So do you think it was harder in those days for ASIO to be able to intercept these plots than it is now, when perhaps those planning them are more obvious?
Yeah, that's a good question. Technology's certainly changed enormously today from then. Arguably, in one sense, it was probably easier back then to track. There wasn't the same proliferation of technologies that made it hard to identify what the sources were. And there's also, you know, there's a lot of people who've done a lot of good things to help Asia over the years. This story is also about those people who haven't actually had a voice so far, who've done remarkable things to protect their country, to bolster security in Australia, and to effectively sideline and undo the work of those with ill intent, the terrorists, those who are keen to conduct sabotage or break the law in Australia. So there are a lot of people talked about in this story who do really try to help ASIO to do its job. Now, there's a couple instances in there of people who were hired to do that and who were then co-opted by the groups that they were planted in. And, of course, that then led to a series of really damaging exposés to ASIO. But the plus side of that is it led to significant reform, additional reform within ASIO. So while those incidents with a couple of young women who were recruited and assigned to work inside Trotskyist groups really at the time was quite traumatic for ASIO. In hindsight, it's actually had a pretty positive effect in terms of refining and honing procedures. But as I say, this is a story of a lot of people who otherwise, you know, having done what they could for what they believed to be the right thing for the nation as best they could, are having a story told about what they did in a way that puts it in context. So this is a story about looking at Australia in the 70s and 80s through the glasses of an ASIO officer or an ASIO agent. And it's quite a unique undertaking.
Now, there are always fears in ASIO about the possibility of moles in there and that they'd been penetrated. From your account, it seems that probably they were, but it wasn't an enormous thing, but also nobody could really put their finger on it. Is that a fair summary of what you found?
Nobody could put their finger on it until after the fact. There had been a number of investigations over the years looking for, you know, surely there must have been a mole in ASIO, people thought. I mean, the Brits had been compromised, the Americans had been compromised. Surely it had happened in ASIO as well. And yet there was just no conclusive evidence for so long. Repeated investigations were conducted and, led nowhere, frustratingly led nowhere. There was a sign in the early 1980s that there was a mole and investigations were carried out and they just went to ground. Then again in the early 1990s, further investigations that George Sedill was very much wrapped up in weren't nearly as satisfying as he had hoped they would be. But what does happen is, and this is something that happens after the period of the history, is that a number of people are identified and so there is some reform and significant change in the organisation, but that's outside of the scope of the book, which ends in 1989. So what we've done is, as best we can, tell the story of what's happening up until 1989 with the knowledge of the time and with a degree of hindsight to explain what was happening inside ASIO, the efforts to deal with penetration inside ASIO through to that period of 1989.
Certainly in Britain, we've had colourful characters over the years who've turned out to be double agents. That doesn't seem to have happened in Australia. They don't seem to have been colourful if they were there. But what do you think leads people to go down that route? Is it money, or do they become convinced about the cause, or were they always convinced about the cause and got themselves into ASIO?
Yeah, it's a very good question. My sense is that the espionage ring of the 1940s and early 50s was one of ideology. That after the Hungarian uprising and the Prague Spring of 1956 and the Prague Spring of 1968 and the splintering of the communist movement into the Communist Party of Australia, Marxist-Leninists and the Socialist Party and the Trotskyists' tendencies. And there was a lot of disheartenment in the hard left, if you like, the revolutionary left. And so there was really, it kind of unravelled. The aspirations that people had in the 40s about doing this for a cause, something they believed in, there's very few people who really did believe that by the late 1980s. And the ending of the Cold War was because of the fact that the great Soviet monolith basically sputtered, it ran out of steam. So what motivated people in the 70s and 80s appears to be primarily money and a sense of grievance. Grievance against colleagues, against the system, about lack of recognition. Now, that's an anecdotal account because the book doesn't focus on explaining motives for espionage and for being a double agent. But there is certainly a sense there that grievance and money was were fundamental.
These days we seem not to worry about the Russian spying so much as the Chinese spying. And, of course, we had accounts of how with the new ASIO building they were bugging it even before the ASIO could get in, which seems to be really cutting to the chase. But in the period you cover, had the Chinese started to be active in Australia in spying?
Yes. It's very interesting. The sections that deal with China's presence in Australia speak to a very different modus operandi the Chinese had to the Russians. They operated in a very different way, and it actually took ASIO quite some time to get its head around what that meant for how it organised itself.
And to get the language skills, one would imagine.
Language skills, but more so more about methodology. The Chinese approach was not the Soviet approach at all, not heavily reliant on operations in and out of the embassy presence.
So how did they do it?
Well, that's a good question, we try and address that in part. But it's the thing is that it is so completely different to the approach taken by the Soviets that in the period covered here, ASIO hasn't quite mastered it. ASIO hasn't quite mastered it. It's realising it's got a bigger challenge than it had anticipated, that the approach taken against the Russians isn't the one that's going to necessarily work. It's demonstrably not working against them. So they try a few things that end up blowing up in their faces.
For example?
Well, there's the very public furor about what might have happened to the Chinese embassy in the 1980s, in the mid-1980s.
This is the Australians bugging the Chinese embassy in that period.
That's what the press reports say. That's how the press reports describe
as opposed to the Chinese bugging the ASIO building.
As opposed to China bugging the ASIO building or the Russians bugging Australian embassies, which is talked about in it too. But what's realised is that the approach taken by the Chinese is much more about not so much picking out one, having one, KGB equivalent officer heading up the operation out of the embassy, but a much more diffuse approach to collection of intelligence. That made it much more challenging because then where do you start? The threshold's lower, the quantity of people involved is much greater, the task is infinitely more difficult.
As you were ploughing through ASIO archives, you must have sometimes felt, maybe I should be writing a novel, maybe I'm in the middle of a spy story that's as fictional as it's fact. Did you ever feel like that?
Yeah. Well, certainly. I owe a huge debt of gratitude to my colleague, Dr. Rhys Crawley, who's the co-author of this book. Rhys did a lot of the research for all three volumes. We brought him in as a co-author for volume three as we were running out of time and resources to finish the additional volume, which we promised late in the piece, thinking we could stretch it to 89 a lot rather than ending it in 1978, which is what we'd originally promised. So Rhys did a fantastic job in helping pulling that together. And I'm, as I say, I'm indebted to him for being a great colleague, great co-author, but also a great help in pulling it together. The question you raised, though, actually has generated echoes in my mind of John Le Carre, his experience, you know, and the tales that he tells of people resentful of his writings, people concerned about the revelations he put out there about methodology, about countering espionage, about the way you did the business, the trade craft, as they call it. This is not an autobiographical account. It's not a novel. It's an official history about the organisation, and yet so much of it arguably could be a script for a Le Carre novel.
And maybe someone will take it and adapt it. Thank you very much for talking with us today, and that's all from our Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.